you recall the picture that was up there a moment ago, same blue sweater. My mom, rest her soul, did not dress me this morning, but that's what it looks like a little bit. So I've been flying under this banner that I call the C.S. Lewis Forum for 10 years. It's back 10 or so years ago that I began to teach with the Victors group. And Ray and John and others who are here will have heard some of what I'm going to talk about this morning. So I appreciate their patience. What are we going to talk about? Erudition. Erudition? Really? What's that? And why is that important? It's not very spiritually inspiring as a topic. It is not theologically edifying. But this has to do with a man who many consider the greatest Christian writer and thinker of the 20th century, if not the last 500 years. And I'm talking, of course, about C.S. Lewis. So I met Tuesday morning with Jeff Smith, and Jeff said, we have an opening coming up on Sunday. Would you like to fill the slot? So most of what I do, in fact, everything that I do, I don't have a broad-based ministry. I teach the writings and the life and the key ideas of C.S. Lewis. That's it. That's what I do. And I have 10 courses that I've taught. And the five on the right-hand side are all things that I believe people who are interested, genuinely interested in C.S. Lewis, need to know those things about Lewis. So what I'm going to talk about today is a slice of the one that's called Man of Many Geniuses. And it's really about the incredible, absolutely incredible mind that this man possessed. Stunning. The five on the left side are specific works. My favorite book by Lewis is The Problem of Pain. I have a very extensive course on that. It's worth reading. I've done The Great Divorce. That's my second favorite book by Lewis. Very important. The Abolition of Man, I do. The ironic thing is it's the shortest book he ever wrote, 92 pages. And yet it's my longest presentation by far. It's long. And then I think the most interesting and compelling one on the list is The Weight of Glory. I don't know how many of you have read it. If you haven't, I highly recommend it. If you as a group want good fodder for a study, The Weight of Glory is spectacular in that regard. So these are big programs. All of them are at least 300 PowerPoint slides. They go up to 1,000. They're large. They're major efforts. So in meeting with Jeff, it's like, what can you do in one session? And that's not easy. So I took this slice out of Man of Many Geniuses, and I created a program today that hopefully we'll be able to get through. Now, what I've done in the last year or so is I've taken the C.S. Lewis Forum and I've created a Facebook group that's called the C.S. Lewis Forum, and I'm building membership of people who are interested in C.S. Lewis. There's a lot of C.S. Lewis groups on Facebook, and I participate with all of them. I've also just recently launched a YouTube channel because I think if you're going to get information to the young people today, you can't do it through books. They don't read books. They're not going to read books. They watch videos. And so if you want to reach them, you have to go with videos. So with the C.S. Lewis Forum Facebook group, I've done two studies. One was, what are the favorite shorter writings of C.S. Lewis? And this was fun because it was my launch into the Facebook platform. And I and I contacted 30 of the greatest Lewis experts in the world. Peter Kreeft, for example, responded. Max McLean responded. And 30 or so others to the question, what are your 10 favorite shorter writings? Not books, but essays and sermons. Far and away, The Weight of Glory is number one, by a long shot. And then these others on the list are the others among the top 10. I actually compiled a list of the top 75 favorite articles and published it on Facebook. And that was fun and interesting. The question, and the second study I did on the C.S. Lewis forum on the Facebook group, was addressing a question that I've posed. Nobody else in the world has posed this question. Not the greatest Lewis experts anywhere. And I first posed it with Ray's group 10 years ago, based upon just some ideas that I had that sprang from what I knew about C.S. Lewis. And the question that I addressed, and I'm taking a very serious Cliff Notes version today of this study, is it plausible that C.S. Lewis is the most erudite person who ever lived in history? That's a pretty powerful statement. And when I first launched this on Facebook, there were people who said, you're nuts. How can that be? What about Aristotle? What about Aquinas? Or John Milton? All these brilliant people. And oh, by the way, how are you going to prove that Lewis is the most erudite person? And I said, well, you're right. I can't prove it. Can't possibly prove it. But I can build a case for his erudition that people listened to, and a great many people came to the conclusion, you are right, Mr. Motter. It is very plausible that he's the most erudite person who ever lived. That's saying a lot. A lot of erudite people. And what's important here is I didn't say who is the most erudite, because you can't prove it. Is it plausible? Does it make sense that he might be? And so I wrote 33 posts on Facebook. This is a huge study. I really blew this thing out. 60,000 words. It's the length of a 150-page book. Take 4 hours to read my essays, and I reached probably 140,000 people with it. 33 times, there were over 4 million hits. Now, I can't say everybody looked at it, but quite a few did. And I had responses from probably 1,000 people, either saying you're crazy, or it's plausible, or did you consider John Milton, or Pascal, or this person or that. Second question, and this is one of the main reasons I post this survey. We won't really get into this today, because I'm sure I'll run out of time. Erudition is eroding in America, especially among the young. They don't read. They do not read books. They watch videos. They're smart. They're doing amazing things in developing new technology, and they have all sorts of interesting videos that they put on YouTube, training courses and that. They're not stupid, but when it comes to the great thoughts of the great thinkers, they are ignorant. They don't know because they're not getting it at school. The academy threw out the great books long ago, and they're not being taught it in school. Is it a problem? I believe it is. And that's why I'm moving toward YouTube as a way to communicate. So was C.S. Lewis a genius? Well, sure. By any measure, he was a genius. And I think it's plausible that he's the most brilliant, most erudite person. Now, that's an important distinction, because I see that there are 5 categories of genius, and they're all slightly different. And there might be more, but this is the 5 that I've zeroed in on. Genius of wisdom, and most people would say that's Solomon or Socrates. genius of creativity. I think it's Beethoven. The top two names are Beethoven and Bach. Innovation, inventiveness, that's different than just having a high IQ, Thomas Edison. But a lot of people say, well, what about Nikola Tesla? And there's a strong case that can be made for Tesla. Raw intelligence, Einstein, but there's lots of candidates out there. And people like Aristotle, nobody ever measured his IQ. So there's no way of knowing. And then erudition is a category of genius. And I propose that it's C.S. Lewis. And other people say, well, what about G.K. Chesterton or Will Durant or Mortimer Adler? There's lots of candidates. But why is erudition important? So if you consider a moment the television show Jeopardy, and if you wanted to partner up with somebody to win big, do you want someone with a high IQ? Do you want a wise person like Socrates? Do you want an artist like Beethoven? Or do you want someone who's erudite? That's where I would put my money. I want somebody who's erudite. And Ken Jennings, the all-time winner on Jeopardy, is a very erudite person. He's read an amazing amount of information. So what is erudition, and how is it different from IQ or wisdom or inventiveness? Erudition is knowledge gained through the reading of literature. It's not raw IQ. It's not wisdom. Solomon said all his wisdom came from revelation from God. It's not that. It's knowledge possessed by a person that comes from reading. And not reading anything. Sports books don't count. Cookbooks don't count. Romance novels don't count. Business books, I used to have about 1,000 of those, they don't count. But literature, and it's primarily in the fields of English literature, for example, or history, or philosophy, or religion, or linguistics. The truth be known, erudition is really not often even applied to science and mathematics. And the test I use is if I'm having personal problems in life, physiological, spiritual, moral, relational, financial, who are you going to call? A philosopher, a man of religion, or a mathematician? I guarantee you, I'm not calling a mathematician because I'm not going to get any good advice. They contribute immensely to society, but they're not especially erudite. So synonyms include scholarly, literate, widely read, studious, encyclopedic in knowledge. So who fits that definition best? Who is the most erudite person in history? We'll find out. So it's a hard thing to compare because it's often confused with wisdom and high IQ. But erudition, if you were going to look at metrics, you might say, well, how many books did the person read as a metric of how erudite they are? Umberto Eco, who died a few years ago, he said he had a personal library of 50,000 books. C.S. Lewis's personal library was 6,000 books. But Eco would be the first one to tell you, I didn't read all those. And how many of us have libraries at home of 500 books or more, and you know you've read 25% of them, and the rest of them, not. Yeah. Joseph Stalin claims to have read 20,000 books that he took out of the Kremlin and he annotated. I don't believe that. That's a big, fat communist lie. And anybody who challenged him on that ended up out in the gulag somewhere, or worse. There's a New Age Bhagwan, spiritual man from India. He says he's read 150,000, or he said, because he died some time ago. He didn't even live to be 60 years old. And 150,000 books means he read 8 books a day, each and every day, 7 days a week. Yeah, right. Or is it the number of courses taken? Michael Nicholson, Dr. Michael Nicholson, he's actually recognized by the Education Association as being the most academically credentialed person in America. He has 30 university degrees. I don't know from where. Benjamin Bulger holds 14 degrees from University of Michigan, Harvard, Oxford, Stanford, Indiana University, first-rate schools. And then Fred the Worm McGregor completed 738 courses. I thought 17 hours a semester was a heavy load. This guy's taken 36 classes a year. I don't believe that either. So erudition comes from literary reading. And it doesn't mean just passing books in front of your eyes and then forgetting them. You know how you used to do cramming for your finals in college? You'd slam all that knowledge into your head the night before the test, go into the test, spew it all out into a blue book, and 2 weeks later it was all gone. You forgot every bit of it. Rote memory doesn't work. It's got to be something more than passing it before your eyes or streaming it through your ears. It means comprehending fully what you've read, not an easy criteria, and retaining completely that knowledge. So here's an interesting analogy, just to put in perspective the scale of erudition in the world. This is a graphic representation of the Library of Congress in Washington. Now, it doesn't look like this, and it's actually in multiple buildings, but let's say you put all the books in one building, 16 stories high, 200 racks on each floor, each rack 150 feet long, each rack holding 5,000 books. This is just the English books. And just books, not microfiche, not audiobooks, not e-books, not pamphlets, none of those other media formats. This is just hard copy books in English, 16 million books. So I use this just kind of as an example of what Lewis read. So Lewis's home base was in the green and blue area, literature, linguistics, philosophy, theology, religion, which is about 23% of the collection of English books. History is the largest. Lewis spent a fair amount of time in the history section of Bodleian Library. He never went into the science or math section. He had no use for math especially. I had a number of people who were participating with me on my Facebook series that said Lewis couldn't possibly be the most erudite because he didn't read any math. Well, I beg to differ. I don't think you have to read math to be erudite. I think you need literature and philosophy and religion and theology and history. Those are the things that make someone erudite, not math. Math is great, but they're different things. So in order to set an upper boundary for the number of books a person might read in their life, 150,000 books is ludicrous, I created what I think of as a mythical occupational reader. No such person has ever existed. But if someone had a job and their job was to sit down and read 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year, and read at a fast pace, 450 words per minute is a fast rate. And this lucky occupational reader doesn't have to understand what he read and certainly doesn't have to remember. That person would read 20,000 books. His or her entire career, 20,000 books. It's instructive to see what a small percentage of the Library of Congress's books in hard copy in English that this woman read. After a lifetime, she has read less than 1/8 of 1%. Those four little marks in the middle, that's what she read. Her whole life. How is anybody going to be massively erudite? Well, somebody has to be. Otherwise, the world devolves into utter chaos. I'll tell you, our founding fathers were erudite. Thomas Jefferson is on the list of the 12 most erudite people ever. My list. Ben Franklin just missed it. John Adams was very erudite. James Madison was very erudite. I suspect Washington might have been as well. But the point is, you can't really read a lot. So in my broader research, I looked deeply at 12 different factors that constitute erudition. I don't have time for that today, so I'm just going to hit the five that are most important. How many books did the person read? What was the value of the information that they read? Did they comprehend the author's original meaning? Can they recall that knowledge when needed? When you're pushing the button on Jeopardy, does that information come into your head? And then what, most importantly, in some ways, is what did they do with it? What's the point of erudition if you just sit in your basement and you don't do anything with it? You have to look at what was that person's impact from all that learning and all that knowledge. So I put a number of people to the test. Now, right from the get-go, there's a limitation. You may think Solomon and Socrates are the wisest people in history, and they may well be. I don't know. But they're certainly not the most erudite. Why? There were no books back then. There were scrolls and parchments, but they were few and far between. Those two men and many who followed, frankly, in my opinion, if you were born before 1800, you didn't have access to books. Libraries were few and far between, and their collections were small. Thomas Jefferson had 6,200 books. His was the largest collection in America, and larger than Harvard, larger than anyone else. And he bequeathed his collection to the Library of Congress, and that's what started the Library of Congress, Thomas Jefferson's personal collection. There wasn't even a University of Virginia down the street from where he lived with a big library. He hadn't founded it yet. He had nowhere else to go for books. So 6,200 was it. I presume he read them all. But so this criteria that books had to be available washes out a lot of candidates. In my opinion, almost everybody born before 1800. Now, on my list of top 12, five of the 12 were born before the 1800, but they didn't make the final cut. And so again, Aristotle, Aquinas, Milton, it's tough for those people to have read many books. Now, how many books did Lewis read? There's no hard data on this anywhere. So I had to go into my readings of C.S. Lewis, where he made comments about his reading, his quantity of reading. So I took two approaches. One is a bottom-up build, and another one was a top-down approach, trying to decide how many books did C.S. Lewis read. And so I looked at four major phases of his life, how many books were in those locations, how much did he read, likely, massive quantities. And at the end, I come up with, this is interesting, 20,000 books that C.S. Lewis read. Same amount as that occupational reader. Lewis did read faster. And so Lewis's 20,000 is similar to this mythical occupational reader, but let's take, for example, someone who's a voracious reader. Maybe there's a voracious reader in this room. There aren't many people that read two books a week, every week, for their entire reading life. That's a lot of books. That person reads 4,800 books, which is a lot less than C.S. Lewis. Or a moderate reader. This is where most people fall. They read, less than one book a week, maybe one book a month. They read 700 books over the course of their entire life. It doesn't sound like a lot, but 33% of Americans don't read a single book of literature after they graduate from high school for the rest of their lives. A third. They don't even show up on this. Okay, so I plugged Lewis in at 700 words per minute. Experts will tell you that anybody who claims anything higher than 600 words per minute is fudging. Anything faster than that, and they're just scanning. You may recall from the 50s and early 60s, all those commercials on TV about Evelyn Wood, you know, and she's going down through the pages like this, flipping pages as fast as she can. She is scanning. Jimmy Carter says he reads at 2,500 words per minute. That's a lie. He's scanning, and that's obvious from his performance. The higher the claim speed, the more cursory the scanning. So in my opinion, to claim that you can read 2,500 words per minute is sort of like trying to immerse yourself in German culture as you're riding down the Autobahn at 200 miles an hour, looking out the window. Boy, that's interesting. Can't see a thing. So let's talk about the second factor, Lewis's broad range of knowledge. You have to have fields that you read in. So Lewis's main field was literature. That's what he was a professor of, English and Renaissance literature. And so that's a big field, and it has six subfields. But he also spent a lot of time in philosophy and religion and theology departments, a lot in linguistics, and a fair amount of his time in history. So he's pretty broad in his reading. So anybody who said Lewis is narrow, that doesn't really hold water. So here's an interesting example of what Lewis read. This is a project that he did for the Oxford University Press. They invited 12 of the leading thinkers in England, each to commit to writing one of 12 volumes in the most ambitious program ever of its kind, called Oxford History of English Literature. Lewis took the book on English literature in the 16th century. He was responsible for that class of books and for that period of time. It is said, Lewis himself said this, that he read every single book written during the 16th century for his research. He read the entire works of 200 plus authors, and some like Shakespeare have a long list of books. And he read another 1,000 books about literature in the 16th century. So I was curious about this, and Lewis, he read everything in the Duke Humphrey's library. It's a section of the Bodleian, and the Bodleian is the large library in Oxford, one of the great libraries of the world. The Duke Humphrey's library is where they keep all of their books from the 16th century. So I called them. How many books do you have from the 16th century? They were amazing. Six people got back to me. And the first answer was, there are 6,575 books for the year 1600 and earlier. Well, that's interesting, but I'm interested in just the 16th century. So I went back to him. I said, how many from 1500 and earlier? And I'd subtract that amount. 33 books from the 15th century, 1500 and earlier, which means Lewis read 6,500 books. He said he checked out every one, and that's been audited. People have gone back in and proven that he took out every book in Duke Humphrey's from the 16th century, and he read them. Who does that? Really? That's pretty amazing. So what's so important about the 16th century? Well, if you ask historians, what are the most important centuries in human history, they'll say it's the 20th century, it's the 18th century, and or it's the 16th century. Well, the 18th century was the age of the Enlightenment. That's when the destruction of the West began. The 20th century, with Marxism and the two great wars, is when the demise of the West took place. You can't respect those two centuries very much for that. The 16th century was a time when Western civilization was really built. I think it's the most important century in history. It's the high point of the Renaissance. It's the era of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. It's the era of scientific revolution, the age of discovery, the rise of capitalism and industrialization, the explosion of the printing press. That's the reason why there are very few books from 1500 and earlier. Printing press wasn't invented until 1454, and it wasn't commercialized until well into the 16th century. Rise of universities, population growth. For the prior two centuries, population on the planet was going down. And it began to increase again in the 16th century. And this is when people began to move from farms into cities. The only bad thing in the 16th century that I'm aware of is probably the reign of Henry VIII. He was rather nutty. But it was the Elizabethan age, the Shakespearean age, and it's also when the British East India Company was founded, which totally changed commerce in the world. Global commerce began with British East India. So hugely important. And so Lewis knew everything about the 16th century. You want to talk to somebody who understood the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation? C.S. Lewis did. He read everything. Nobody's had a greater grasp of the significance of the 16th century than C.S. Lewis. So the next issue was, how well does someone comprehend the author's original meaning in the books that you're reading? It's one thing to pick up a book by Plato and buzz through it and understand about 10% of it and forget that 2 weeks later. Lewis claimed that he read the books from antiquity in the original language. He spoke 4 modern languages, but he spoke 9 ancient languages. And so when he would read books like Lydgate's Siege of Thieves, he read it in the Middle English. And you can look at that yourself. And although it's called English, you can't understand a word of what they're saying. It's exceedingly difficult. He read everything he could in the original language. Now, these are photos that I took in the Wilson Library at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. That is where Walter Hooper, who was Lewis's great secretary, bequeathed his collection, not of books written by C.S. Lewis, but books owned by C.S. Lewis, books that Lewis read. So on the left is Lewis, a photo from Lewis's book, Plato's Republic. It's in Greek. He read it in Greek. In the middle, Lucretius, On the Nature of Things. It's in Latin. Augustine's Confessions. He read it in Latin. I couldn't do that. What's interesting about the Plato's book is that it's a unique format of the book. On the left-hand page is the book in the original language, which is Greek. On the right-hand page, it's the text in English. All of Lewis's annotations and marginalia and underscores were on the left-hand page. It's fascinating. Proof that he lived up to what he said he would do. He was blessed with extraordinary talent for decoding ancient texts. I've tried to read a couple from the Middle Ages, and it is really difficult. Not only the words they use, but everything about how they communicate is different. The cultural setting was different. The politics were different. The theological context was different. Their vernacular was different. They used words differently. They used metaphors differently. Even their jokes go right over my head. Lewis understood all that. He said at his first lecture at Cambridge, when he's standing in front of a sold-out house of his new peers at Cambridge, "I'm an old Western man. I'm a dinosaur. I read those ancient books as a native. You read them as a foreigner. So who's extracting the content, the author's original meaning? C.S. Lewis, probably better than anybody ever, because of his ability at comprehension. He knew what Plato meant, and Aristotle, and Aquinas, and Augustine. Now we come to his retention. Comprehension and retention are the two most important factors in this game I'm playing to determine who's the most erudite person in history. Lewis had perfect comprehension. So we get to retention. How well did he retain it? He had a reputation in Oxford and Cambridge for having near perfect retention, meaning everything he ever read, he remembered. Golly, I can be on page 23 of a book and I've already forgotten what's on page 17. You know, it's hard. It's hard to remember. So he was so often put to the test to prove that he could do it. And so Kenneth Tynan was a famous, angry young man in the 1960s from England. He was a student of Lewis's, and he a number of times would put Lewis to the challenge. And basically, Lewis lived, you know, in his quarters in Oxford. He had 3,000 books. And in his home in Headington Quarry, he had another 3,000 books. So most of the time, it was going on in his quarters in Oxford. Lewis would turn his back to Tynan or anybody else. Go pick any one of the books you want. And he'd keep his back turned so he wouldn't see what he was pulling down. And so Tynan would open the book up to a page of his choosing, go to a line of his choosing, and read that one line. And Lewis would say, stop. That's such and such a book. You're in the 11th chapter. And he would be able to recite from memory the rest of that paragraph, the next page, and the next page after that. That's a gift from God. I mean, that's just unbelievable. Perfect comprehension. Perfect retention. How can you beat that when it comes to erudition? And he read 20,000 books. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. There was another test put on by an American student there, Richard Selleck. He was a Rhodes Scholar. This was at the event of Lewis's final night in Oxford before he was going the next day to assume his new role at Cambridge University. And so Selleck, being a smarty-pants American, said, I've heard about your perfect memory. I don't believe it. Prove it. Lewis is kind of, oh, here we go again. He sends him down to the Bodleian, pick any book you want. So he comes back with Lydgate's Siege of Thebes, written in Middle English. That's Middle English. Tell me if you can understand any of that. I can't. Read a line from it. And so Lewis finished that page and the next page in Middle English. Wow. That's just wow. And it's considered to be the single most boring book in Bodleian Library. Students hated having to slog through that. So he had unparalleled. Nobody's ever had a memory like this that I'm aware of. Was it photographic memory? Was it audiographic memory? Or was it something else? Well, for those of you who believe in photographic memory, I'm going to burst that bubble. There is no such thing as photographic memory. There isn't. Nobody has it. And the proof is, and the scientists have looked at it, if you had photographic memory, I could take Ray, if he said he had photographic memory, and I walk him through the parking lot out there, and 7 days later say, tell me what the license plates were. Nobody can do that. Or Ray, tell me a book you read. And if he had photographic memory, he ought to be able to read the words backwards. Nobody has ever been able to do that. Photographic memory does not exist. People have visual memories, or there's something I think audiographic memory makes more sense. Senator Ted Cruz has audiographic memory. He says he never forgets anything that he hears. Not that he sees, not that he reads, anything that he hears, he remembers. And that kind of makes sense to me, because when I'm hearing a song from the 1960s, I'm not looking at a score of that song. I'm not looking at the lyrics or the music, but I can pretty much predict exactly what the next few lyrics are going to be and the melody. And that's not from photographic memory, that's from audiographic memory. And we all probably have some ability to do that. Or when I'm in front of somebody and I forgot their name, I'll silently go through the alphabet, A, B, C. And eventually I find a letter T that resonates, and I'll work Thomas, Tim, and I can, more often than not, figure out what their name is. That's audiographic. That's not a picture of the letter T. That's the sound that the T makes. But I think it's all something else. It's the experts on memory say that memory is more like a puzzle than it is like a photo. What does he mean? Well, when you're putting together a puzzle, this piece right here has a lot in common with this piece right here. Their images overlap. That's the way a puzzle, that's the way you put a puzzle together. And their belief is that's how memory works. You get on some piece of information, and that enables you to recognize or recall that contiguous piece of information. Makes a lot of sense to me. And it's similar to this memory theater concept that goes back to Aristotle. Cicero used it. It's a technique you use where you associate an idea that you want to remember with some feature. So people tend to use a place that they know well. They know what their house looks like. So if they have a speech they want to remember, they start with the front door. The door knocker, maybe the doorknob handle, and they mentally associate this idea in a mental image with that door knocker. They open the door, and then there's something else there, a statue, a bust, some flowers, a mirror. They walk through the whole house. Each step of the way, they can remember what's in their house, but they've got a different idea associated with it. And that's how the great orators remember their speeches. Because it's like a puzzle. It's not like a picture. Now, the other thing he did is, you know, he had an incredible natural gift, but he also had best practices. He used annotations and marginalia specifically. So if we were to go back to the page of Augustine's Confessions, I underlined one line in it, and it was that one line that in Latin means God made you for himself and our hearts are restless until we reside in him. Probably the single most famous line from Augustine's writings. And so to hold in my hands that book that was C.S. Lewis's book, he had marked it with a pencil. And that's where that idea first came to light, when he underscored that. For me, it's just an amazing experience to spend time with his books. If you're a Lewis fan, you know how important Fairy Queen and Edmund Spenser are. I held his copy of Fairy Queen in my hands, and I was just blown away. Here's an important book on the left, Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. When he was a young man, this book, more than any book, convinced him he should be an atheist. More than any other book. And years later in life, he reread it. And so he, on the right-hand side of a page, he jotted down his thoughts. And I've underlined that this was a very difficult reading, psychologically difficult reading. And then on the lower line, he says, this poem is the work of an unbalanced mind, and it's filled with errors. So this was when Lewis said, I'm done with Lucretius. That's bunk. He was well on his path to being a Christian when he wrote this. And then he did something called a praesis at the end of his books. He would mark down in order all of the key ideas from that whole book, summarized on a single page so he could go back to it later and reread all of his thoughts. Not many people do that, but he did. And I went through probably 50 of the books there that were owned by Lewis, and every book, same thing. His marginalia, his annotations, his praises. So we come to the final criteria, and it's what did he do with this knowledge? He wrote 32 books, great books. He wrote 200 plus essays or sermons on all kinds of topics. Had a great contribution to mankind through his writings. And he didn't just write about Christianity or theology. He wrote about philosophy and philosophical fallacies. He wrote about literature. He wrote about consciousness, imagination, reason, a myriad of topics. And if you decide you want to invest time in Lewis, you can do a lot worse than reading his shorter writings. They're magnificent, really. And he had all of these great thinkers down through history, authors, philosophers, theologians, mystics, that he read everything that they wrote. It was all in his head. And so in comes the brilliance, the great thoughts from the great thinkers. Out comes what C.S. Lewis had to say that has influenced a great many people in history. When you look at his 32 books, he wrote The Chronicles of Narnia. It's not the best fairy book ever written. That would be Lord of the Rings by Tolkien. He wrote Screwtape Letters, which is satire. Probably the most famous satire book would be Animal Farm by George Orwell. But Lewis's is up near the top. He wrote The Problem of Pain, a theodicy. Peter Kreeft, who wrote his own theodicy, and a theodicy means an explanation for why God allows pain, evil, and suffering. Kreeft says The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis is the best theodicy ever written. It's magnificent. Lewis wrote 22 genres in 32 books. He's all over the place. Tolkien wrote one genre, fairy. He didn't even have any academic writings. One genre, fairy. This is incredible. And then we come to the Socratic Club. This is one that few people know about. And those who know about it, he used to go into the Socratic Club and argue with these great thinkers, don't understand that the Socratic Club, which he built, played a pivotal role in the development of modern Christian apologetics. Okay? There's nothing he did, other than his books and his shorter writings, where he contributed more to Christianity than what he did with the Socratic Club. He brought skepticism out of the shadows. He gave confidence to Christians who were scared to go into the public arena, the confidence that they would do that. He developed a counterpoint approach and the assumption of civil dialogue never been tried before in Oxford. It has never been surpassed as a vehicle for debate about Christianity. The Socratic Club has never been equaled. The impact is huge. So as I went through the study, I collected recommendations from participants who were playing along with me and my silliness. And who do you recommend? Well, this is the wrong page. These are people that Lewis went out to find to stage the debates in the Socratic Club. So there were advocates like Owen Barfield and Austin Farrar, Michael Polanyi, Dorothy Sayers, really smart people, and some big names on the adversaries. A.J. Ayer, Jacob Bronowski, Anthony Flew, J.B.S. Haldane, C.E.M. Jode, smart people. They would come in to the Socratic Club and they would think, I'm smart, I've got good arguments against this Lewis chap. He'd blow them away and they'd never come back. Can't say I blame him. So this is where it gets interesting with this analysis I did of books read. Lewis read 20,000 books. He had perfect comprehension, perfect retention. So I'm saying, okay, maybe 10% of the books he read were not literature. Tristan Shandy, writer Haggard, he had certain authors he liked. A voracious reader reads 4,800 books, has 60% at most comprehension, retains at most 30%. A lot of what they're reading isn't really literature. And then there's avid and then there's moderate reader. So Lewis, compared to these classes of reader, he read 4.2 times as many books as the voracious reader, but he had 35 times the amount of knowledge in his head to go into the Socratic Club with. And for the moderate reader, most of us, he had 1,000 times as much knowledge in his head as they did. So I don't know where the professors are on that list, but it doesn't take much to believe that he had at least 10 times as much information in his head as they did. These were smart people. They read a lot. They had good memories. But he, you know, it's something to say this person knows 50% more than me. It's quite a different thing to say this person knows 10 times what I do, or 130 times or 1,000 times more than I know. So John Wayne was one of his students. John Wayne was a successful poet in England, and he used to, when he was a student, he'd sit in on these debates, and this was Lewis's show, a kind of prize ring in which various champions, the adversaries, appeared to try their conclusions with Lewis, who week after week put on a knockdown, drag-out performance that was impressive. Our time has produced no better debater. I can remember packed meeting rooms. The students used to show up in droves, sit on the floor. And he says the atmosphere was positively gladiatorial because the students were all rooting for Lewis, which is pretty amazing. And so a lot of them said, that's it. I'm not coming back here ever again. That makes sense. So at the end of his career, this professor who was thoroughly disrespected by Oxford University, they never had the sense to make him a full professor. They kept him as a tutor. The full professors could be heard walking around campus talking about everything they were going to do to squash Lewis's aspirations of ever becoming a professor. So Cambridge says, what? You know, it's kind of like if the University of Georgia were looking at Georgia Tech, and Georgia Tech had this tutor, his name was Isaac Newton, and they wouldn't promote him to be a full professor. University of Georgia saying, that's crazy. Let's create a chaired professorship for this Isaac Newton guy and bring him over to Georgia. And that's what Cambridge did. He finished his career at Cambridge. But that's when he really got recognition. Time magazine, his picture was on the cover of Time magazine. The professors at Oxford hated him for that. He's not allowed to write books like Screwtape Letters. And here he is. He never even went to America his whole life, but he's on Time magazine. He's elected fellow of the British Academy. Most of them weren't, for his English literature in the 16th century. His greatest book that he ever wrote. It's also probably his least read. In 2000, Christianity Today said, the two books of greatest spiritual influence, number one was Mere Christianity, number two, Screwtape Letters. That's pretty impressive. Number three was Chronicles of Narnia. In 1951, Winston Churchill offered Lewis, at the bequest of King George II, the honor of Commander of the British Empire. It is the highest award a civilian can ever earn in England. And Lewis turned it down. He was so humble, he knew in 1951, this will just make those Oxford peers of mine all that much madder. So he turned it down. He probably regretted it because 3 years later, he's over at Cambridge. And then, less than 10 years ago, Westminster Abbey finally put a memorial stone on the floor in Poets' Corner for C.S. Lewis. That's an amazing honor. And the irony is it's in Poets' Corner, And Lewis wanted to be poet laureate of England. He was an okay poet. It was his only failure in his life. And yet he's in Poets' Corner. So he got the recognition he deserved. So the 12 candidates that I wrestled with, and this is sort of chronologically top row to the right, Pascal, Milton, Leibniz, Samuel Johnson, very much like C.S. Lewis, Thomas Jefferson, bona fide, erudite person, Chesterton. Lewis wrote 200 and some essays. G.K. Chesterton wrote 11,000 essays. Now, I don't think his books are nearly as good as Lewis's, but he wrote a lot of essays, and I think that's where Chesterton did his best work. Churchill did a lot of research on history. Will Durant, The History of Civilization, exceedingly well read. Lewis, Mortimer Adler. Adler is the fellow who created the idea of great books of the Western world, first published in 1954. A collection of 475 books that he considered. This is the canon of Western civilization. These are the greatest books. And canon's an interesting concept, the greatest books, because I heard Jordan Peterson speak about canon on the YouTube a week or so ago. And in Jordan Peterson's mind, canon doesn't mean the conclusion of humanity's great thoughts as much as it means the beginning of mankind's. So books in the canon are the books that inspired other books downstream. Other books to follow were inspired by Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and all the books that are on Adler's list. And so consequently, Peterson said the number one book, the taproot of all the other books in human history in the West, is the Holy Bible. That's the very taproot of wisdom, of humanity. Isaac Asimov and Umberto Eco, I boiled it down to the top four and determined, surprise, surprise, C.S. Lewis was number one. Mortimer Adler, very strong candidate, brilliant man, read a lot, wrote more books than Lewis, but he wrote more narrowly. Chesterton and Will Durant would be my top four. Now, yours might be different. Certainly, there were people that were participating on this ongoing dialogue over 4 months on Facebook with me that might take issue. But I think everybody would agree that Adler and Durant belong on the list. So here's a syllogism that I put together, and I assume we're running out of time, pretty close, that I think is meaningful when you're considering erudition. If Christianity is not true, then the books that describe Christianity and seek to bring you into a closer relationship with Jesus, this mythical Jesus, if it's not true, are meaningless books. If Christianity is not true, then much of what C.S. Lewis read is of no merit as erudition, because he read everything about Christianity, whether it's literary learning or not. If Christianity is not true, then there's no way Lewis could be the most erudite person in history. It's probably Isaac Asimov, who is a skeptic. He wrote a book once I read, Isaac Asimov's interpretation of the Bible. And I read through it and I was unimpressed. He's a brilliant man, but he was out of his comfort zone speaking about something like the Bible. However, if Christianity is true, then there's nothing more important than books that bring you closer to Christ. Nothing's more important than that in the scheme of things. Moreover, if Christianity's true, then a large part of what C.S. Lewis's erudition was extremely important. Not only did he read a lot, and he read valuable information, and he comprehended everything, and he retained everything, and he wrote marvelously about all of this, a large part of Lewis's erudition was extremely important. And then the final point that brings it all home, Christianity is true. It is true. We all believe it here, I know. So I'm not going to really go into this because it's one of my hidden purposes for why I did this. Yes, I want to encourage people to read C.S. Lewis. And there are varying degrees in this room of familiarity with C.S. Lewis. Some of you have read quite a bit. I know Ray has read a lot, and Peg probably too. Others have read one or two books, but I would encourage you to read more. More important than that is I aspire to figure out some way to get young people to read Lewis. I don't think they're ever going to read Chesterton. I don't. I don't think they're going to read George MacDonald. They should. They won't. I don't think they're going to read Milton or Pascal. They'll never do it. I think there's some chance they might read C.S. Lewis. Some, but I'm not sure. And I think that's a huge problem in this country. Because our founding fathers, as I said early on, they read the great books. And they created this incredible country. And I'm concerned that we're passing it on to a generation that doesn't know anything about that stuff. And that's problematic, I think. Let me just skip forward since we want to close. There is one person that's broken the code. I mentioned Jordan Peterson earlier. He's a clinical psychologist and university professor from Canada. He is huge on the internet right now. The left hates him with a passion. Because it's not because he's conservative, but because he speaks the truth about identity politics and social justice and postmodernism, and he's absolutely brilliant. He's got only two books. He understands that if you want to reach young people, you have to do it through video. He must have 1,000 videos out there. And they're brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I've listened to several hundred of them. And they're watched by millions, and he's having a huge impact on young people, especially young men. 90% of his viewers are young men. And that's good. It'd be nice to have the young women on board too, but you know, you have to start somewhere. So that's it. I'm welcome any questions you might have. I'm not sure there's any time left. 2 minutes? Three? Okay.
Do you know, Jim, if...
Are there any of his books, C.S. Lewis' books, they're now in audio?
Oh, all of them.
They are?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Even just this summer, they released English Literature in the 16th Century. His least read book is now available in Kindle format and audiobook. So almost every book.
That's great. Thank you.
Do you know why Hooper decided to chose North Carolina for the books and not Wheaton?
He didn't have anything to do with Wheaton. Wheaton has the largest collection of Lewis's books, the books that Lewis owned, because a professor went over and bought them. And Marion E. Wade, who is the founder of ServiceMaster, funded that. And they have like 2,500 books that Lewis owned. The University of North Carolina has 110 or so, but they're very important books in the Wilson Library, very important books. Walter Hooper was an undergraduate student at North Carolina, and then he taught at Kentucky, and then he went over and he worked as a secretary for Lewis in Lewis's last couple of months. And then he was nominated to be the trustee of Lewis's literary estate. And he was a magnificent man. I had the great blessing of meeting him one time. And, you know, so it was just, wow. He had a huge impact on the world.
I just had one simple question. Einstein, when he died, gave his brain to science, which was put in a jar and held in Princeton underneath a desk for I think, about 50 years till somebody discovered it again. Did C.S. Lewis do the same thing?
No, he's buried outside a little church in Headington Quarry in Oxford. He and his brother are stacked in the same grave. Lewis was down first because he went 10 years before his brother Warney, and then Warney's at the mezzanine level of the grave. Other questions?
I'm speaking as a non-native speaker who does not have English literature training. I was exposed to Mere Christianity in 1974, and I tried to read it, and I was just not able to read it. It took me 20 or 30 years when the Harvesters put a course on Mere Christianity about 6 years ago. And I tried to read some other original writings by him, and I just give up. I could not just follow through his intellectual somersaults and all that. But what I found out lately was that there's one booklet that was paraphrased version of some of the key teachings of C.S. Lewis, which was extremely helpful. Is there any attempt to publish a paraphrased version of C.S. Lewis for non-native speakers?
I haven't seen books like that. Many people experience the same thing that you did. Lewis can be challenging to read. And let me offer a perspective on that, and you may think I'm obfuscating. But Lewis was a magnificent communicator. Magnificent. The reason that he's hard to understand is not because he's not clear. It's because he's telling you something you've never heard before.
Exactly.
And so the first time you hear any idea, whether it's reading C.S. Lewis or reading something about random scattering theory in a scientific field, it goes right over the head. And the second time you read it, you get a little bit more, third and fourth. I've read Mere Christianity 50 times. Problem of Pain, 40. Abolition of Man, 30 times. And every time I read The Abolition of Man, it's 92 pages long. Something new. It's like reading the Bible, you know. You read the Bible, and every time, something new comes out at you. And that's the way Lewis is. And so I'll be reading The Abolition of Man, and something that I thought was really difficult and dense, I'll say, that couldn't be more clear, the way he said it. But you have to wrap your mind around what it is he's saying, and that can take some time. It's not an easy thing doing that.
Thank you. It might be easier in audio.
I think so. A book that's well read by a good reader is easier to understand because he or she puts the inflections on the sentences in the right way. And that can make a lot of difference in how you interpret a sentence or a paragraph, is how it's read. So for me, the best of both worlds is I'll sit there with a Kindle book open on my iPad, and I'll listen to it at the same time. And that works for me. But then, you know, I'm reading his books 50 times. I must have a lot of time to waste.
Jim, thank you so much for
your presentation today. Being here.
Some thoughts we clearly wouldn't have bumped into on our own, so thank you for your diagnosis. I appreciate that.